Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show where we explore the many paths to transformation and aim to mine a few nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, even though sometimes that might feel counterintuitive, just like the nightingale, a bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, also known as the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted to have you join me today. I have a wonderful guest with me who will share a painful yet heartwarming and thought-provoking story with us. We'll hear from Richard Tyler and his descent into dealing with cancer shortly. First, today's show is brought to you in association with NasalGuard, the drug-free nasal gel that uses electrostatic technology to block harmful airborne contaminants. It blocks indoor and outdoor allergens, so it's great for travellers as well as people with pet allergies. And it could also be a boon for people who suffer from hay fever, especially since we've been warned of high pollen counts here in the UK this week. I'm sure we don't have quite the same problem as people in Wichita, Kansas, though. A place I always associate with the Glen Campbell song Wichita Lineman, but I've recently found out the city's real claim to fame is as the hay fever capital of America. And that's exactly where Tammy Taylor lives. Her hay fever symptoms can be so bad, she uses nasal guard spray rather than a gel to top up her allergy shots, and that way she can remain functional during the season. I asked Tammy how she came to use nasal guard.
So I'm going to say it's been 13, 14 years ago now. I actually had an allergy workup. So I had all the pricks on the skin and told me exactly what I was allergic to here in Kansas. So it was everything from the grass starting to grow, the bees moving the pollen, the trees starting to bloom, flowers, and then going all the way through summertime. And once we found out what I was allergic to, my allergy doctor, you know, we're going to give you shots, but there's some extra boost type of thing that you may try. And so he gave me a long list of different things, and nasal guard was in there. I tried to keep as natural as possible. I don't like a lot of medicines, and nasal guard was something that seemed to work for me here in the middle of Kansas.
How bad was it? How did it affect your life?
Runny nose, red eyes, coughing, just because of the drainage all the time. Some days were worse than others, so I would try to stay in, but you know, you could only filter so much from the outside to come in. But I take a couple showers a day when I'm out and about, because trying to get the pollen and off the body and change clothes, it was quite an ordeal.
How did nasal guard help you?
Well, with the allergy shots and then being able to use that, and I use it probably definitely twice a day. Some days it was probably three times a day. Just kept my sinuses moist for one thing, but then, you know, opening it up.
Do you find it intrusive, or do you find it really easy to use?
I find it very easy to use. The applicator, you know, give a squirt and a sniff. And so I do it in the morning, especially during my allergy times. I don't have to use it quite as much during the winter times. You know, I kind of have a cycle that I am an avid user or type of thing, but no, I carry it, you know, in my purse, and therefore if I feel that it wears off, I can go to the bathroom and it's just a little applicator that you take off the top and, you know, it squirts up in there, and I always hold the other side of my nose and do the sniff and then change and sniff it up. And I find that the little squirt is about the right amount, you know, and then I let it set for a minute to see if it starts to effectively work. So it's just one spray into each nose, and continue on my way. Seemed to, within 10, 15 minutes, can feel some more breathing, or better breathing, I guess.
So you find it very easy. You carry it with you all the time. And it does sound like you've had a really, you know, you've been dealt a very bad hand when it comes to allergies. How does it make you feel when you know that you can actually go about your life?
Well, it's definitely made it a lot better. I mean, makeup's not running down my face. Like I say, I took those allergy shots. And so that did reduce it during and has continually to reduce it. It makes a big difference once you can get that, you know, before I start to get on a phone call or something. And it's natural, so it's not necessarily a drug. And if I feel that I need a squirt before I head into a meeting or something, I know that I'm opened up and be able to speak without sneezing, snorting, or coughing.
Yeah, that's important as well, isn't it? Because it's not a drug. So you can use it, and you're using it in conjunction with your shots. Yep. So what it does is it gives you that extra help that you obviously need. And so how long does the season last there? I mean, you have allergies all year round, do you?
I do not. So mine start probably the end of February, 1st of March, because that's when here in Kansas, everything starts to activate after coming out of the winter. Mine goes through our corn harvest. So as a child, in the middle of the wheat harvest, the wheat dust and everything. And then we also planted corn, and that was my most, so corn and wheat overlapped. Wow. Yeah. And the flourish pollen part of the corn is the same time as the wheat dust. So my end of June, 1st of July, which is coming up, is my heavy season. And then end of August is kind of when harvest finishes with what I'm allergic to. But then it goes into another harvest of soybeans and milo and stuff, but I'm not allergic to those. So I would say March through the end of July is my season.
Yeah, well, that's long enough, isn't it, to be suffering? Tammy, thank you so much for talking to us about your experience with Nasal Guard. I'm really glad that it's helping you out. Tammy Taylor with her Nasal Guard success story there. And if you want to try it for yourself, just click on the link on the UK Health Radio homepage to order. And while you're on the homepage, do take the opportunity to vote in the UK Health Radio Awards. Voting closes at midnight UK time on Sunday, the 23rd of June, so don't miss out on voting for your favourites. And if you're listening to this after the 23rd and missed the deadline, sorry about that, but do watch out for the results coming very soon. It's been an eventful week. We've had the summer solstice, immediately followed by the strawberry moon, which is a significant event for my special guest today. Richard Tyler is the author of a new book out on June 29th called As a Kite Falls, A Voyage Through Descent. It's a beautiful and very personal journey of finding hope within the darkest of times. The true story of how Richard went from West End star, turned successful therapist, best-selling author and motivational speaker, to getting a world-shattering cancer diagnosis, being told he had 3 months to live, and adjusting to a very different life. But his book is far from a pity party. Rather, it poses the question, what support is there for people on the descent in life rather than the ascent? It's also punctuated by many of his haiku, like this one. Sweet strawberry moon, heralding in summertime, illuminating. The poem prefaces a memory of bathing in the light of a strawberry moon and recharging, a reminder to seek out whatever we need to restore body, mind, and soul. Well, we'll hear from Richard himself in a moment, but first it's time to hear these messages.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Good, good.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist. And you'll have heard before the break, hopefully, that my guest today is Richard Tyler, who's charted his journey dealing with a rare blood cancer diagnosis in his book, As a Kite Falls. I asked Richard to tell us, first of all, about the impact his diagnosis had.
Well, thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here with you. I mean, look, I knew that something was hurtling towards us in respect of my health. I knew there was a diagnosis on the way. And the closer we got to that diagnosis day, the more I sensed it wasn't going to be great news. Just cues that I picked up on from the doctor and from the hospital that it wasn't good. But nothing really could have prepared me, I think, for a diagnosis of a cancer that was so aggressive, that it's actually so rare. So it's a type of blood cancer called mantle cell lymphoma. Generally, they tend to be diagnosed quite late anyway. So it was already stage 4B. I had quite a lot of B symptoms. There's only 600-700 people in the UK diagnosed with mantle cell. You can't really track down mantle cell specialists. In the US, that's really important that they have a mantle cell specialist, but in the UK, there aren't really any. So, I mean, the diagnosis, I guess, it felt as if it picked up our family and kind of tore us into little pieces and scattered us on the floor in order for us to then kind of rearrange those pieces into some semblance of order. And I will in every cell in my body remember that diagnosis coming towards me, and remembering probably 5 minutes after I got the diagnosis that I tuned out. I deferred to my wife to make some sense of what was happening, make some sense of starting chemotherapy the next day. Knowing that I needed to go home and tell a 16-year-old that her dad had a cancer. I was told not to Google it because what I'd read online wouldn't be very palatable. I think I'm really lucky that healthcare, and especially with blood cancers, has evolved so much in the last few years. The prognosis now for mantle cell is better. It used to be 3 to 5 years was about it. It is better now. And but you know, at that time I just remember going into a place of I guess barricading my life a little bit. I didn't want to speak to anyone. It was weeks before I said to anyone I have cancer. I wasn't able to form those words. I didn't want to watch telly. I didn't want to read. I didn't want to listen to music. I sat and looked out the window for a few weeks. Pretty much that was it. Treatment started in earnest the following day. And I mean, it was brutal. You know, I have a 16-year-old daughter. I have a wife. For all of us, it was brutal. And whilst it felt as if we walked this collective path, the three of us together, experiencing similar responses to what was going on, we also all walked our own path. And I think that's really important to remember when people are in some kind of descent. They were, as they walk their path, the people around them may walk a collective path, and they also have to be, I think, given the space and the respect to walk their own path. And my wife needed to walk it in her own way, her own pace. My daughter needed to. And maybe only with hindsight I'm able to look back on that. At the time, I don't know if I fully understood that. But we started off on our own adventure, and we continue to. But that day, December the 7th, 2021, will be forever etched in my heart.
It was a severe blow would have been for anybody. But you had been hugely successful. You had a successful career in theatre. You were in all the big shows. And then you were a very successful coach, motivational speaker. You were really flying high. And then
it felt that way. And I you know, the book is about our relationship with ascent and the culture we live in that encourages and celebrates ascent and up and more and bigger and better and brighter and faster. And I was swept along with that. That was very in my familial system. My dad lived that way, grew his own business. And so I grew up with ascent. I grew up being encouraged to fly higher and fly faster and be better. But not at any point was I ever taught about my relationship to descent, my relationship to what happens when our kite plummets and when we go into free fall. I was never taught how to deal with that. I'd experienced a lot of descent in my life up to the point that I got the diagnosis. But as so often is the case, I was never encouraged to sit amongst the descent. I never said, actually, you need to be in it. You need to be with it. You need to build a relationship with it. You need to understand and mine for the wisdom and the treasure in there. I was encouraged to get out of it as quickly as possible and ascend again. Find the positive and ascend. And that's what I'd done. And it felt like this diagnosis that literally brought me to my knees and brought my own mortality right into sharp focus. There was no swerving. There was no quick fix to go, how do I just ascend again?
How do you cope with that?
Maybe the way people cope with it, especially around cancer, is to have that kind of fight it, the fuck it attitude. There is a lot of that energy around illness. And that sense of we have to beat it, and that was never, and maybe for some people that is the ascent. How do I ascend as quickly as possible by kind of trampling on the cancer, beating it into a pulp, and kind of grabbing hold of the kite tails and flying again? I didn't feel that was what I wanted to do. I had been brought to my knees, and this was not going to be a quick fix. I had months of chemotherapy ahead of me. I knew I had a stem cell transplant ahead of me. So this was no quick fix. So faced with that choice of, which felt quite binary, of do I get into that fight it mode and push through and attempt to hit cancer's ass, or do I find a way to be in it and to swirl around in it and to roll around in it and to make some sense of its purpose. And I believe there was a purpose. I had no will to find out what that was at the point of diagnosis, but I believe there was a purpose for all of us, actually, for Kelly, for my daughter. There was a purpose for it.
Kelly's your wife, of course.
Kelly's my wife, yeah.
Did you feel that as a man, this was particularly difficult for you to be with this, you know, this new person who was in full flight descent? Because as a man, you're expected to be that fighter, that person who just goes out there and wins.
I talked a lot of my work before being ill was certainly around as a therapist around mental health and depression and anxiety and the risk we run of pathologizing all mental health and all crises that we have in our life. And I guess I was brought up in a patriarchal system. That did, as my dad especially had a bit of a tough it out energy, a bit of a kind of grow a pair, you just kind of get on with it attitude. He had a day off, one day off ill in his entire career, because he'd had his appendix out the day before. But other than that, I mean, he never took a day off. So I had grown up with that, and yet I've always wrestled with, I never felt I fitted in with an alpha male group of men. I've never actually known very well how to be around men. If I'm faced with a group of men, generally I'm unsure how to enter that group of men. I don't do football. I don't do particularly blokey things. So I'm like, well, what do I talk about? I don't generally enjoy the company of men because I just think I'm not quite sure how to bring all of myself to it. I always grew up, with this urge to sing and perform and be a part of theatre. And I had naturally quite, if you think of it in terms of Eastern traditions of Shakti and Shiva energy, I think I have quite a lot of feminine energy. And probably what I've had to work at is developing my mature masculine qualities, understanding what that means and kind of thinking about how I bring them to bear. I think there was a hope from people around me that I would react in a way that was kind of tough it out, because that was going to be easier for them. If I toughed it out, they could tough it out alongside me. But I didn't do that. I went for, my world collapsed. And as a result of that, every shred was torn open. I felt enormously vulnerable and naked and exposed. And therefore those who were going to go on this journey with us also needed to find a way to be okay with that. I lost friends along the way after the diagnosis. I have people that I've never heard from again. I have people that reappeared in my life. I had people who were unable to stay the course. And all of that is okay. None of those are bad things. They just are. In the book, I talk about my illness in a way of using seasons and seasonality to describe some of it. And this was, I got the diagnosis in the winter, and this was my wintering. This was my shedding. Everything was stripped from the trees. I was naked. I was exposed. And I had no choice but to live through that season. We can't get into winter and just kind of dress it up and warm it up and stick the leaves back on the trees. We have to go through winter to get to spring, to get to new growth. And I had to trust that. I had to trust that I needed to go through this period of wintering. I mean, literally, I lost a lot of weight during the chemotherapy. I lost all of my hair. And as it started to grow back, I then had a transplant, which meant I lost all my hair again. I lost everything, lost my eyebrows. And so the whole, I was literally stripped back, physiologically stripped back, but emotionally and psychologically stripped back as well.
And so, and I love the metaphor of seasons that you use throughout the book, and also the punctuation with the haiku that you use, which is just beautiful. But in that stripped bare place where you were so vulnerable, there was obviously some kind of strength that came through. And a lot of people talk about the strength in vulnerability. So were you conscious of that? Was that something that helped you through?
I don't know. Yeah, there was. I don't know if I didn't feel very conscious. I felt like, I was 49 when I got this diagnosis, and I felt like I had spent 49 years of my life being in service. Mm. And I grew up in a household that felt quite unhappy. It felt like I had quite an unhappy energy and a dissatisfied and disillusioned energy. And I, as a child, decided that I needed to be the joy bringer. And I did that by helping my mother a lot, to the point of, again, it cost me, I think. And here I was at 49, having spent much of my life in service through theatre, through coaching, through workshops, through therapeutic interventions. And I was here having to find a way to be of service to myself. And I didn't really know how to do that. I didn't know how to serve self. I didn't know what that meant. I probably had always thought of it as being quite a selfish quality when we talk about self-serving. But for me, it was about finding a balance of how do I remain in service to the world. But at this point, there is a desperate need, a literally a life and death need to serve myself. So I guess that brought up a lot of different qualities, perhaps some that I hadn't really utilized much in my life. And I guess strength was one. Will was certainly a quality of I think will is broken into different qualities. I think we often talk about will as strong will, and that's maybe the alpha male bit, the toughing it out, the patriarchal kind of strong will, push on, find a way, you know, keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing till you get through. There are other qualities of will that we think about less. Goodwill is one. But I think the quality of will that we talk about least is a quality of skillful will, which is the clever ways in which we are able to navigate the path that we are on, that we do it with discernment, and we do it with intelligence, and we do it with thought, and we do it with consideration. And I think that quality is utilized less. So I needed to bring will to bear. There were lots of days where I didn't want to take my tablets. I did not want to go back to the hospital to be an inpatient for 3 days and have more toxins pumped into my body. I did not want that. But one of the words that people used to describe the way Kelly and I walked the path was about walking it with grace, and grit. And grit was that kind of the quality that said, we will do all that we can to find our best way to be with it and to move through it. And grace was that quality of more how we move through it. And a humility to it, and I guess a way to find an acceptance of what was happening. And acceptance, sometimes people thought as, oh goodness, you're kind of giving up, you're rolling on your back with your feet in the air going, mm-hmm. poor me. And acceptance is about that, the part of us that will welcome it in. And we did our best to welcome cancer in. I mean, cancer was hammering at our door. And we could barricade, or we could welcome it in. And it was in my body already. So we might as well go, okay, come in, take a seat at the table. Let's kind of figure this thing out between us. And I guess that takes some strength, I suppose. It takes some conviction, and it takes some bravery, because we were going into an adventure that was unknown to, well, certainly very unknown to me. Kelly had walked alongside a lot of people who had lived with cancer. But for me, it felt very unknown. And I was very frightened of leaving a wife and leaving a daughter and not being there for either of them. And days where I felt like where I literally had no strength.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I had an enormous amount of belief. But I guess we muster up something. I think my lowest point, I remember sitting on the edge of the bed. It was a Wednesday, and I had to go to the hospital to have my PIC line cleaned and some medication. And I had taken my tablets. I take my tablets generally. I'll be happy to take a handful of tablets, 10 tablets, and just chuck them in. And here I was with 20 steroids to take and a load of other different painkillers. And I felt so sick. I had to take one at a time, place one in my mouth, get the glass, have the sip of water. And I knew that this all needed to be done in order to get to hospital. And I just I just remember I was thinking actually of Kelly and Mia, and so wanting to have more experiences with them both. I felt like it was something wrapped and entangled with that yearning that got me up on my feet and got me in the car and back to that hospital again. But I remember it being the darkest point, where if someone had said, you know, 20 pills or this one pill, and then this one pill means it, game over. I would have been very close to taking the one pill, because I just felt like I was not going to be able to muster up enough to carry myself through.
But he did, I'm glad to say, with the help of a whole community around him. Well, we'll hear more from Richard Tyler in a few minutes. First, it's time for another short break. Back with more right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest today is Richard Tyler, who's been reflecting on his journey so far with a rare form of blood cancer. He went on to talk about the importance of nature on that journey and how it changed his view of city living in London.
I have always felt like I would never really leave. I at least needed to be able to straddle visiting nature and being very quickly in a city and a town and theatre and restaurants and buzz. And something happened during my treatment, I think. It felt like I was so stripped back to soul. I kind of made this journey home, this journey back to my true essence, and therefore I, whilst I would say I've always been a sensitive soul, I have become more sensitive, and I've become more sensitive physiologically. So one of the platinum-based drugs I took has massively affected my hearing. I've got quite significant hearing loss. Certain frequencies are completely wiped out. I have a tinnitus, which I'd always thought was a bit of a joke condition, really. I'd kind of probably sniggered at people with tinnitus, going, made up, you know, kind of noise in your ears thing. But the tinnitus is significant. And I went into London a few times after my transplant, and it was just unbearable, JJ. It was, I would walk down the streets and the sounds would slice me up into tiny pieces. It just felt a complete assault. And I would get home, weigh up the joy of being sat in a theatre versus all that I needed to get through. And my immunity is pretty rock bottom. It will always be compromised. So going into London, sitting on a train, is quite a big deal. And actually, if I'm not enjoying it, then it's an even bigger deal, because I'm not only putting my own health at risk, it is less enjoyable. So we made this choice to make a move from London out to Wiltshire and to buy a small holding and live with animals and live quieter life. And I have never felt so settled and soothed as I do now. I mean, we talk about nature being a healer, and it really is. And I think we're only just starting to learn and see the science of that, and the science of how nature and green spaces and our connection with Mother Earth and our connection with plants and greenery and the air that we breathe, the impact that has on our physiological health and our psychological health. I mean, enormous studies done into the impact, especially on our mental health. And I, for the first time in my life, am feeling that. And I feel the pull to it. And if I spend a day in a town, it exhausts me, and I am desperate to get back to our garden and to park myself on our bench or to go and sit with our chickens. And you know what? There is also a part of me that feels like I've run away. And I'm very fortunate as a therapist. I have a need to continue having therapy, and I'm grateful for that because it gives me an opportunity to kind of unravel some of this stuff that I'm a little bit baffled by. And I often think about, you know, am I running away from the noise, where actually there's a lot of work to do in cities, especially, and for the people who live there and for the people who don't have access to, say, green spaces, or they don't have access to a community, they don't have access to a place that is safe and where they are firmly held. And there's a little bit of me that feels like a deserter. I've kind of gone, oh, well, you know, you figure it out. I'm going here to live in a field. And I wrestle a bit with that. And you know, Kelly runs a homeless charity, and I still feel like I need to build my connection with helping people who are in a constant state of dissent. And I feel like I still need to bring presence to them and some of the healing that I've been gifted and offered and found myself, but I still need to bring some of that to them. And that was a part of the reason we set up a blood cancer charity 2 weeks after being diagnosed. And a part of moving here into the countryside was about how can we give back some of the healing that I have been gifted? How can we give that back to others who are living with cancer, families who are living with cancer, families who have young children living with blood cancer? We definitely, a part of living here is about how do we help others also heal their own lives and help communities heal through what we learn here, through what we bring to the countryside here, to what we gain and the richness that we get from the countryside ourselves. But nature is vital. And I noticed that the speed at which my nervous system settles when I am out in the garden or when I walk the dog across the fields, and I get the awe of spaciousness around me and what my body feels as if it is able to soak up, I feel better, and I feel better in my mind, and I feel better in my heart, and I feel better in my body.
And that's quite something, considering that you're still being treated and you still feel pretty awful sometimes, I'm sure.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I have days that are, I have a lot of side, and a lot of people go, well, you know, don't you look well? And look at your full head of hair. And they're like, you can't have cancer. And I'm like, well, no, I have this incurable cancer. And the visit to the outside world, I look pretty well. And I guess it's only me that lays down at night and listens to my tinnitus and notices the neuropathy in my feet and notices the discomfort in my gut. I have to check on a daily basis. This cancer has a high propensity for relapse, and I have to check. It was discovered in my lymph nodes, and I have to check my lymph nodes, and I have to check daily. And I'm kind of living that routine now of going, what if? And nature soothes me. You know, a lot of people need a lot of compassion and understanding and presence, because there are enormous numbers of people in free fall and experiencing crashing and crushing descent, not just through ill health, but through relationship breakdown or financial collapse, losing jobs, being isolated, being alone. We have to learn from what we have done wrong, and we have to start thinking about how we repair some of what is fractured. And this, you know, this is not a short-term fix. This is not how do we quickly ascend. We have to learn from this descent that we are in. And I think that's a mighty big ask for people.
I agree with you, yeah. But I also agree that we do have to learn and get ourselves out of it somehow. Mm. And we are coming to the end. I could talk to you all day about this. But what I want to do is thank you for modelling how we can deal with some of the worst things that life can throw at us so gracefully and be moved to reach out to help other people. And so I do recommend that anybody would read As a Kite Falls. And you talk about, I mean, what's happened to you has been awful, but in reading it, I don't feel down at all because you handle the whole thing so beautifully. And so lyrically, and you're a great storyteller, I have to say. Although it's your story to tell and nobody else's. So thank you so much for that. And thank you for talking to me today. Now, the book is out on the 29th of June, 2024. You're still working, but I mean, hopefully you're not doing too much. You're not pushing yourself too hard as a therapist. If people want to find out more about you, can they follow you on social media? Do you have a website? You know, where can people find out more?
Yeah, there's I'm on Instagram sporadically. I don't do very well on Instagram. but they can find me on Facebook, and they can find. I think I'm pretty findable, and the Willow Tree Foundation is the blood cancer charity that we set up.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
People can we have a group on Facebook, and we have a website, and people can find out there, and that's at thewillowtreefoundation.com. And I think I'm pretty easy to track down, but I am doing little bits of work, and that's it's hard because I feel a bit unreliable at the moment. I still have some treatment, and some days are good and some days are less good. So I certainly don't work in the way that I used to work, which has been an important lesson in this.
Yeah, understandably. And so just on a final note, if you were to deliver one message as a result of your experience and your descent to anybody going through similar, not necessarily cancer, but, you know, so many things can cause us to spiral downwards. What would your message be?
I think it would be, we touched on community. It would be brave enough to do it with others.
Yeah.
And that probably means asking for help. I've shied away from asking for help for my entire life because I can do it myself and I don't want to put upon others. But actually, this forced our hand to ask for help. We had to ask for a lot of help. We had to ask for financial help. We had to ask for support to look after Mia, to look after our dog, emotional support, spiritual support and healing. People coming to bring food to us so that we could come back from hospital and eat something. But I've had to get over that, and I still find it hard. But speak up and speak out, and there will always be someone. There are enormous numbers of people who are wanting to help and will help. And I think that's what we were surprised by, that people will go, yeah, for sure. And we have a group of people who are our kin, I guess. Maybe it's about find your kin, find those people who will walk it with you. Mm. And they are there, but we sometimes we have to ask for them. And we have to ask for them to step in because they just don't know, because we are so used perhaps to toughing it out and being seen as the one who can cope. And maybe we have to dare to shed that, or to dare to loosen it a little bit, the tight grip that it can have on us of being everything and doing everything for all people, is that we just need to loosen that outfit a little bit. Maybe we don't need to strip off and run naked down the street, but if we just loosen some buttons,
I love it.
It makes it a bit easier to ask for help.
Richard Tyler there, and asking for help, that's such an important message, one that I've taken a long time to learn in my own life. I find Richard's story of how he's transforming his life to deal with this stage of it incredibly inspiring, and I hope you do too. I didn't have the time to fit in our entire conversation here, but if you're interested, there's a longer version on my YouTube channel, Alternatively Speaking. Definitely check out the Willow Tree Foundation. That's at thewillowtreefoundation.com, where you can find support if you or anyone you know has blood cancer. If you want to find out more about me, then head over to my website at thepracticalalchemist.uk. And if you're interested in exploring energy healing, take a look at safehavenhealing.uk. It's just about time to leave you right now, though. Today's show was brought to you in association with NasalGuard, the drug-free nasal gel that uses electrostatic technology to block harmful airborne contaminants as well as indoor and outdoor allergens. Thank you for listening. Join me next time for more Practical Alchemy. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.